Now, in this chapter before us, this chapter 5, it's very clear that for poor Timothy, there's not really any sort of guidebook he can go to. There's no kind of Old Testament doctrinal standard he can use as a sort of template for how to deal with this situation or that situation, because this chapter is all about the human face of the Church of Jesus Christ. The humanity of the Church in all its weaknesses, in all its imperfections, in all its sometimes unpleasantness. The Church has a very human face because it is composed of fallen human beings, many of whom are redeemed by grace, but also the visible Church contains those who are not in fact redeemed, but who join with the Lord's people. It is always, thinking of the children of Israel coming up out of Egypt, so likewise the Church on earth is a mixed multitude in that sense. It has a very human face, and even those who are redeemed by grace are in many ways imperfections here whilst we are in this fallen world. And it is human relations that Timothy is required to deal with here. In some ways, you know, it is a marvel that the Lord chooses to make a church of redeemed people out of humanity at all. Wouldn't it be so much easier if he just took the elect angels that had never fallen, never sinned, never put a foot wrong, and said, these will be my people in heaven. I will take the angels and they will just worship me in perfection for all eternity. They've never put a foot wrong, they've never sinned, they've no blemishes, nothing. But the Lord did not choose to do that. He would not have fellowship as such with mere angels, because they are simply ministering spirits, pure spirit. But the Godhead desired fellowship with mankind. Mankind whom he made in his image, male and female, he created them. And not only so, but he ordained it that in the fullness of time, human flesh, humanity would be brought into the Godhead, into the Trinity. Now that's it's an amazing thing when you think about it. You know, the Godhead from the beginning was pure spirit, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit from all eternity. But at a particular point in history, humanity, from the time of the ascension of Christ into glory, humanity was brought into the reigning Godhead above. From the time of the conception in the womb of the Virgin, humanity was part of the Godhead, but it's taken up into glory, and so there is human flesh as part of the Godhead. God has chosen to make a people for himself from this fallen humanity. And here it is with all its imperfections in this chapter here. So it's all about the difficulties, the failures, the problems that young Timothy might face in trying to deal with human relationships within the church. Human faults and failings and difficulties and recommendations and so on. Now, where we have at this outset, rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father. This probably does not refer to an elder in the sense of presbyter. It doesn't mean an ecclesiastical elder, probably. We can't say for certain. But it's just that the context here in verses 1 and 2 would imply that it simply means an older man. Because it then talks about younger men, and then older women, and then younger women. So it would imply in the context, older man, younger man, older woman, younger woman, and so on. When it then goes on to verse 17 onwards, that does refer to the sense of ecclesiastical elder, presbyter, in that sense. But the context of verse 1 would imply not necessarily that. And Timothy is instructed that if there is a fault that has to be pointed out, you can't be as Peter himself, for example, writes in 1 Peter 5, verses 1 to 3, the elders which are among you I exhort, who am also an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind, neither as being lords over God's heritage, but in samples to the flock. It's all good, sound stuff, but they can take it from Peter, not only because he is an apostle, but as he himself says, look, I'm guiding, I'm giving advice to you elders, because I'm an elder myself. Timothy isn't. He hasn't got that sort of natural thought. He's not an apostle. He hasn't seen the Lord transfigured on the Mount of Glory there. He is just a second generation, if you like, Christian. And by that I mean one who is not in the inner circle of those who have seen the Lord in the days of his flesh. He is not one who's been converted by the Lord's own ministry or by the outpouring of the Spirit at Pentecost. He is one who has heard the gospel from an apostle, received, accepted, been converted, been born again, but he's one of the first sort of non-apostolic generation, one stage removed. This means that combined with his youth means he can't just swan around and say to the older men, listen to me because I've got authority here. Technically, he does have church authority, but this is not how to exercise it, Paul says. Just entreat him as a father. Imagine you were trying to speak to your own father and there was something you needed to put right with him. Imagine you were speaking to your own brother whom you loved and who you really wanted the best for. And if you'd something that was a difference between you that had to be put right, talk to him, yes, honestly, but do it with love. Do it with humility. This is no place for dictatorial behavior. If there's something difficult that has to be said, then say it with all love, say it with all humility. If offense is going to be taken, let it be in the thing you're saying, not at the manner in which it has been done. There may still be offense, but take away all excuse. So rebuke, not an elder, but entreat him as a father, the younger men as brother, the elder women as mothers, as though you would your own mother. And of course, the bond of affection between a boy particularly and his mother is always going to be strong for his whole life. So have that kind of gentleness and entreating the elder women as mothers, the younger as sisters, with all purity. And this, of course, is important too. Because whilst there is always the danger, particularly the younger men and young women, that there will be chemistry or a spark or something else, as well as just Christian brotherhood or sisterhood, and even the most predatory of males probably wouldn't feel any kind of desirous attraction to their own sisters. You know, they might have a roving eye elsewhere, but their sister is probably safe from their attentions. So this is how you are to regard the younger women as sisters. With all purity. If there comes to be a wife for Timothy in the fullness of time, and we're never really told if there is, then by all means he can pour all his affection and devotion and attentions of that romantic kind into her, but all the others are to be like sisters with all purity. Now, honour widows that are widows indeed. What does that mean? Well, is there some doubt about whether or not husband's actually dead? No, it doesn't mean that. Now, widow in this context means just as throughout the Old Testament where the Lord has a care for the widows and the fatherless, it means those who are destitute. Because not only their husband has been taken away by death, but also, particularly in that age and culture, it means their entire economic support has been taken away. To be a widow indeed is to be one who is not only bereft, but destitute. Honour widows that are widows indeed. But if any widow have children or nephews, or might say grandchildren, some translations might put, let them, that is the sons or the widow, the nephews or children, learn first to show piety at home. That doesn't just mean say their prayers and read their Bibles and so on. Showing piety, putting their faith into practice, is, as it says here, requite their penance. You know, there's all those years for which your penance laid out for you. When you were helpless, when you were young, when you couldn't do anything for yourself, when you couldn't either feed yourself or when you couldn't provide for yourself, they expended themselves to provide for you. Now when they are old, and perhaps without economic means, you must requite them. It's time to level up the balances. And this is an expression of Christian faith and devotion. It is piety. Show piety at home. And Jesus, of course, teaches precisely this. We think of Mark chapter 7, for example, when he has so little time for those who neglect the care of their parents. In Mark chapter 7, verse 10, Moses said, honour thy father and thy mother, and whoso causeth curseth father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, if a man shall say to his father or mother, it is carbon, that is to say, a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he shall be free. And what that means is, if somebody were out of piety to say, oh, everything that I have, it's devoted to the Lord. It's given to the temple, it's given to the Lord. And because it's set apart in that sacred way, I can't give it to you. Mum, Dad, I can't use it to provide for this temporal needs because this is a holy thing. This is sacred. It's all given to the Lord. So, sorry, I just have to leave you. And if you're in difficulty, well, that's just tough because it's all given to the Lord. Jesus said that's like an abomination. How can you, by supposedly devoting something to the Lord, break God's very commandment in doing so? It is carbon. That is to say, a gift given to the Lord, given to the temple, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he shall be free. And ye suffer him no more to do aught for his father or his mother, making the word of God of none effect through your tradition, which ye have delivered. And many such like things do ye. So this is perfectly in line, this is exactly in line with the teaching of Jesus. Show piety at home. Requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. Now she that is a widow indeed, again, without any other means of support, again, it's not a question of whether or not she's actually bereaved, of course she is, and desolate, with no other means of support, trusteth in God. In other words, she takes her needs to the Lord because she doesn't know where else to go. It's not simply that she is more pious than those who have a bit more economic means. It's that she has nobody to turn to except the Lord. She is literally dependent on the Lord for the food that she eats day by day. She is desolate. She trusteth in God and continueth in supplications and prayers night and day. Now, this isn't just a reference to the fact, well, a real widow is going to be constantly on her knees. But it's a fact that she depends on the Lord. And she also, because she now no longer has family commitments or husband commitments or whatever, she can give herself to the Lord. You know, instance of this, remember that the widow in Luke 18, verse 7, and the unjust judge, where, you know, she asks for justice and she goes back and back to the unjust judge and he says, though I fear not God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubleth me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. And the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge saith, and shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? That's the sense of it. The widow crying day and night, supplications and prayers night and day. Think of Anna in the temple when the baby Jesus was brought in. Chapter 2 of Luke, verses 36, 37, there was one Anna, a prophetess, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was of a great age, had lived with her husband 7 years from her virginity, and she was a widow of about 84 years, which departed not from the temple, but served God with fastings and prayers night and day. And presumably for her sustenance was dependent on the alms, the givings of those who came to the temple. But another reason why we ought to be, widows are enabled to in this context, and all of us ought to be mindful of the Lord and dependent on him night and day, is because you can be assured that the devil is active night and day. These godly widows are described as impleading the Lord's throne night and day, day and night. Remember what it says about the devil himself. In chapter 12 of Revelation, at verse 10, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. He is constantly at his evil work. It is necessary, therefore, the Lord's people be constantly at their divine work, at the devout work of seeking the Lord by day and by night. Not everyone is able to do that physically. They've got their work, their employments, their duties, and so on. We all ought to be making time, yes, the beginning and the end of the day for the Lord and for our devotions, but it's not possible to wait on him constantly and discharge all our duties and our works and so on. But the widow in that situation is, in one sense, freed up to do that. But in another sense, how is she going to live? If she has no relatives or loved ones to care for her, what is she to do? This is where it says the church is to take care of her. She that is a widow indeed, and desolate, trusteth in God, continueth in supplication and prayers night and day. But she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. In other words, one who has just gone back to the world again, instead of from the Lord, is spiritually becoming dead, even while she's physically alive, and liveth in pleasure. That is the sense of going back, as it were, to worldliness. These things given charge, that they may be blameless. Now, part of the concern in this chapter is that the Christians, whatever their state, whether they're married or single or widowed or office bearers or not, should be living in such a way as not to bring any ill repute upon the church. The witness and testimony of the holiness of the Lord's people was part of their witness amongst the godless heathen. Whatever they may have said or the doctrine they may have believed, people would see, recognize, and be impressed by the faithfulness, the holiness, the godliness of the walk and the witness of these people who called themselves Christians. And this was an essential, not an optional extra, an essential part of the testimony. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. In other words, you know, just like Jesus was saying in Mark 7 there, if you've got the means to care for your widowed mother or aunt or whatever it may be, and you just leave them, destitute, you don't care for them, you don't bring them into your home, you don't look after them, you don't in any way provide for them or help them, then how are you living as a Christian? You've denied the faith. You're worse than an infidel. Even infidels would care for their own. And for their own loved ones and for their bereft. It's worse than an infidel. Now, of course, some people would, with some justification, extrapolate this verse further and say, what is true for heads of households to care for the vulnerable and those who have no protection of their own is true also for heads of nations. And this they would take as being a verse that would justify, you know, a strong defense force or you know, armed forces and so on, because it is the protection, the defense of their country, their nation. Of course, that's not the original context, but we can leave that aside. It is a verse that allows for greater application. But if any provide not for his own, especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. It's never just about going to church, reading the Bible, saying your prayers. It's about putting this into practice and letting love flow out, that inner spring of the Spirit that bubbles up and flows out into every aspect of what we do. Now, when it says, let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, it doesn't mean, well, don't classify her as a widow. If she's a widow, then she's bereft, of course. Now, but the suggestion here is almost like an order of widows. And it is thought by some commentators that what we have a reference to here is almost like an order of those who have become kind of official church widows, who had particular works and tasks of charity which they were engaged in, which they were busy about, whilst they were being sustained and provided for by the church. Idleness, remember, as you see in this chapter, was regarded not simply as a vice and something a Christian shouldn't be doing because it's, you know, not a good witness or whatever, but also as positively dangerous. To have too much time on your hands and doing nothing with it, the devil will soon come in and fill that. In fact, we can point to, you know, waves and cycles in history when a society becomes affluent and comfortable and leisurely beyond a certain point, all manner of evil gets in. All manner of depravity is sought out because people no longer have to scrabble about to make ends meet. They don't have to just subsist. They don't have to work all the hours that they can in order just to get by. They're comfortable. They've got a safety net. They've got a sufficiency of affluence. And so all their particular needs are met. So they look around for things that aren't needs. They look around for entertainment. They look around for a bit of indulgence. And this is one reason why you'll find that a particular sin that afflicts our modern society, that of homosexual practice being really trumpeted as a major sort of a virtue, this arises almost always when a society has become peaceful and wealthy and where there is idleness. Now, if you look at what it says about the sin of Sodom, I think, in Ezekiel, it's not just referring to sexual behavior, but fullness of bread idleness, pride were in her there. All these things combine to cause people to have, oh, let's look around for something to entertain. Well, we've tried this and that's not satisfying us. Let's try something else, a little more daring, something a little more sort of risky, something a little more bad. Idleness is not only a vice in and of itself, it is dangerous. It is that which the devil will seize upon and use to turn to his purposes rather than God's purposes. There is, in the, you know, that good Reformation principle, the so-called Protestant work ethic. It's not so much Protestant, it's just Christian. It's what the Bible teaches, that we should be active and busy with that which is profitable and good and worthwhile. So this order of widows, the number of the widows who were being cared for by the church, there's a suggestion that this was in practice already happening in the days of the apostles themselves. If we go back to Acts 9, where you find Peter going to visit the home in which Tabitha or Dorcas had died, you read in Acts 9, verse 36, there was at Joppa a certain disciple named Tabitha, which by interpretation is called Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and alms deeds which she did. We don't know that she was a widow, of course, but she was very active. And it came to pass in those days that she was sick and died. Whom, when they had washed, they laid her in an upper chamber, and they sent for Peter, and so on. Peter then, he put them all forth, kneeled down, prayed, turning him to the body, said, Tabitha, arise. She opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. And here we have verse 41 of Acts 9. And he gave her his hand and lifted her up, and when he had called the saints and widows, presented her alive. Now, that doesn't state explicitly that Tabitha was herself a widow or one of an order of widows, but it's just a little hint. Implied that those people active like Tabitha with good works and alms deeds and so on, and blankets and so on that she had made, they came showing Peter, you know, the garments and coats which Dorcas made while she was with them. She was busy, she was active, she was like the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31. These widows, sustained by the church, were busy for the Lord. Active for the Lord, serving, working. There was no idleness in them, because now their human husbands had been taken away. They had given themselves now to another bridegroom, and they were being sustained by the church and helped by the church to do this. There is the sense, the suggestion, that they were bound together in this sort of order, almost, of church widows, or presbyteresses, some would put it as. But let's go on church widows. Not to be taken into the number under 60 years old, 60 years old. Having been the wife of one man, and you remember what we said, and compare that with what we read in chapter 3, verse 2, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. So a husband of the wife of one man, well reported of for good works, if she have brought up children. And that doesn't mean that those who have been childless in their marriage are somehow to be excluded. But rather, to bring up children doesn't mean they had to be simply biologically your own. But there would in those days, particularly, you know, when medical care was nothing like what it is now, there would have been a far higher proportion of orphans than there are now. Also, there would have been cases of people who, not unknown within, you know, a generation or two from our own day, if people had children and their resources were strapped and they couldn't afford to feed all their children, they might lodge them with an aunt or a cousin or whatever. And quite often you might have cousins or aunts or uncles who were childless themselves, but who would bring up children for other members of the family. They would stay in their home. They would be almost like surrogate parents to them. And it's in that sense, I think, we should understand that if they didn't have biological children of their own, that they would, you know, make themselves available to bring up others who maybe either had no parents of their own or whose parents were no longer able to care for them. So it's not simply, well, unless she's had children herself, she jolly well shouldn't be brought into the know. But the caring for children was seen as a good work. They didn't have to be necessarily just your own. But one who has practiced this, and who, in other words, has kind of proved her love for those more vulnerable than herself, if she had lodged strangers, she had washed the saints' feet, if she had relieved the afflicted, she had diligently followed every good work. This would imply that they're looking for people who, by their own nature, would be doing the kind of things which the church widows, if you like, themselves, would be engaged in. caring for the poor, the afflicted, the sick, and so on, just like Tabitha was doing. So those who would be sustained and kept by the church and bound into all of like this church order, this sisterhood, these were the kind of women they were looking for. But the younger widows refuse. For when they have begun to wax wanton against Christ, they will marry. Now, again, that's something we have to be very careful with. There's nothing implying, it's not wrong to remarry, as is made clear further down. But the suggestion is that perhaps there were those who had been brought into this order of church widows, who had been sort of engaged in this work, but because they were younger and because, you know, they had more energy perhaps than the other ones, they began to get a bit restless and got a bit fed up with what they were doing here not rebellious in the sense, in the wrong sense, but their energies were too great for what they were given to do. They wanted to sort of break out a bit. They will marry, having damnation or judgment because they've cast off their first faith. Now, it's not wrong to remarry, and nothing should be implied from this, but the wrongness, the judgment is that having, as it were, bound themselves exclusively to Christ as their bridegroom and to this good works in which the church widows would be engaged, you know, if they were going to go off and marry before, why didn't they do that before rather than sort of become part of this body dependent on the church in that sense? If there's opportunity to remarry, they should do so. That's what Paul writes, verse 14. I will therefore the younger, doesn't just mean younger women, he means younger widows in the context. Bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. In other words, be engaged about the things that are right and appropriate for their situation. Again, idleness is the enemy of the Christian. Verse 13, they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house. Now, there is the implication also there at verse 12, that perhaps these younger widows in seeking remarriage or whatever were perhaps being content with a marriage to somebody who's comparatively godless, or perhaps a pagan, or perhaps somebody who was a Judaizer or whatever, who were turning away from their first love in Christ in order to seek this romantic liaison, or at least this human satisfaction of being cared for and looked after. Perfectly understandable. But that is something which is a danger in every age. And right down to present day, both with men and women, there is a danger that, especially if people perhaps think, oh well, if I don't take this opportunity, there won't be another chance. If I don't accept this person's affections or attentions, this might be the only chance I get. It's all very well for these other people who've had loads of suitors and loads of admirers and so on, and maybe they're better looking than me or prettier than me or whatever, but this might be my only chance. And here I am widowed now. Who's going to look at me anymore? I've got to take this opportunity, and maybe the person isn't a Christian, and maybe the person isn't particularly godly. And when that happens, whether it's a man marrying a woman who's lukewarm towards the Lord, or a woman marrying a man who's not a Christian or whatever, there will at best, be a diluting of their devotion to the Lord. Even if that non-Christian, or not red-hot Christian, says, I'll come to church, we have no interest in it, but you know, I'll come out to church, and that's what we'll do, there has to be give and take, this is what I'm doing for you, what are you going to do for me? So for me, you're going to come off some of these church things you're involved with, you're going to be a wee bit less devout, because I'm coming out for you, come on, we're going to meet each other halfway, and at best, there will be a diluting of their devotion to the Lord. At worst, there will be a complete and total falling away. And this is partly what is meant. Having damnation or judgment because they have cast off their first faith. And this, you know, without being condemnatory, this is something which is a very real human danger. People inevitably want to feel that they are the object of somebody else's attentions, affections, or desire, or whatever. And whether we're talking about men or women, it isn't the most natural thing in the world when somebody shows an interest and an affection to want to reciprocate that. But if they are someone who is going to draw you away from Christ or to dilute your relationship to Christ, and it must be diluted. Because as Paul says, you know, 1 Corinthians 7, there's a difference between whether an unmarried man or woman and a husband or a wife. They have to devote part of their time, their attention, their desire to please to the other one. That's what marriage is about. If they are both the Lord's, then they will have that same goal and same objective. They will be able to support one another in what they're seeking to do. Their relationship to Christ will not be diluted, but rather it will be strengthened. So there is this very human danger. And this is what Paul is saying. It's not that, oh, you Ephesian Christians are so much worse than everybody else. We see the human face of the church here from every nation, every culture, every generation. The same dangers, the same pulls and attractions this way or that way, for men, for women, whether they are bereaved, whether they're completely unmarried, or whether they're struggling in marriages that are no longer happy. And withal, they learn to be idle, to lose our first love, to be drawn away from Christ is the most dangerous thing that can happen to a soul. I will say that again. To lose our first love, to be drawn away at all from Christ is the most dangerous thing that can happen to anyone. So therefore, Paul says, you don't want the younger women or widows to marry. Yes, their children guide the house, give them on occasion the adversity to speak reproachfully. I think we must take it as read that verse 14 implies marry another Christian and therefore do all the things that a Christian wife would be engaged in that context. Or some are already turned aside after Satan. Again, the implication, not simply, oh, they've remarried. Big deal, but rather they have remarried to those who are drawing them away from the Lord. So his desire is that if they're in a position to remarry, then do so, but do it in the Lord and serve the Lord in your marriage or in your widowhood, with your wife, with your husband, or in the single estate. And as I've said many times before, we have often failed perhaps to honor the single estate as perhaps we ought to. Some were already turned aside after Satan. The importance here is of staying focused on the Lord. If any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged. It doesn't just mean so the church can save its money and send off more to central offices or whatever to Jerusalem, but that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. Those who don't have any other means of support, the church will have to support them. And that's only right and good, but it's not right if there are those who could look after their own mothers or aunts or whatever, or grandmothers, and they're not bothering to, and then so the church gets charged. That just means there's less to go round with everybody else. I don't imagine that there has ever been a church, a genuine church in any age, which has, you know, is awash with resources and is wondering, what on earth are we going to do with our money? There's just so much money in the church pot. What on earth are we going to do? There's only so many big churches we can build, only so much we can expend it on. We've just got so much money, we don't know what to do with it. Nobody has ever been in that situation. Resources are always more straitened than you would like. There would always be less resources to feed and clothe and provide for the true widows than the church would have liked. There's always a greater need than there is already supply. That doesn't mean the Lord doesn't supply. Of course he does. But we are dependent on him from day to day. And we have to steward the resources that he does give us. So this is another reason why it says, like with showing piety at home, verse 14, verse 4, I beg your pardon, any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. Now I think if we go on in subsequent weeks, we'll deal with the eldership itself, with ruling the church, and with the necessity of caring for those relationships, that ruling power, and care for the self. But I think if we've reached here at verse 16, a natural demarcation point down between the first half of the chapter and the second. We have to recognize that the focus here is upon these human relationships and the need that whatever state, or married, or single, or widowed, or whatever, our first focus must be on the Lord. And that anything that draws us away from that is something to be regarded as dangerous, something to be regarded as potentially ruinous to our souls. It's not something that we can say, it's okay, I can handle it, because I'll change them. I'll make them more, because I'll be a good influence on them for good. Yeah, that's great. If you are a bath that's totally filled with boiling water, and a bath that's totally filled with freezing cold water, and you had a big bath twice the size, and you poured the two of them into, what are you going to have? Just lukewarm. Neither hot nor cold. And we know what the Lord says about that which is neither hot nor cold. The focus has to be upon the Lord. And if the focus is upon the Lord, then those human relationships of which the church is composed will be done right. Any rebuke or admonishment will be done with love, with gentleness, with humility. Relationships between the young man, Timothy, or other young men and sisters in Christ will be with all purity. Grandmothers and grandfathers in the Lord will be honored. Those who have no other means of support will be supported. Those who can be supported by somebody else will be supported. And remember, of course, that in those days as well, it's not just a case of love and marriage wasn't just about sort of romantic involvement and who takes your eye. There would be pretty much a degree of arrangement and of bringing people together, just as there are in Christian communities in other parts of the world, in Asia and Africa and so on, where Christians are few. To find a fellow Christian of manageable age, of the opposite sex, for marriage and family life is sometimes a very rare thing. People are in great difficulties in communities because they can't get Christian husbands or wives of a suitable age. So there will be an arranging, a bringing together, where it is possible to do so. People always say, oh, no, I don't really fancy that one much. No, they don't take my fancy. I don't really feel my heart beating and breaking for them. So people were realistic about putting the Lord first and all other relationships follow. That is what the Lord requires of us. And it is the least that we can return to Him.